72 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, one newly recorded, one from the morning show archives, both surrounding interesting topics related to the game of football. And here's part one. As another season of college football is about to get underway, a really important new book has just been published, which seeks to explore the way in which the world of big-time college football has descended into what some would call a kind of madness. Chaos is part of the subtitle of this extraordinary book called The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. It is a comprehensive look at big-time college football and the way in which the injection of extraordinary amounts of money have changed so much about the landscape, changed the way in which big colleges and universities look at their student athletes, what that term student athlete even means, and the kind of decisions that coaches and assistant coaches and athletic administrators in this arena are forced to make, particularly choices in order to allow them to remain competitive, and the lines that sometimes get crossed on a very, very regular basis. The book is co-written by two gifted writers, Armin Katayan, and my morning show guest, John Talty, who is the national college football writer for CBS Sports and 247 Sports, and the author of the bestseller, The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban, the great football coach at Alabama, who figures very prominently in this book, which is published by HarperCollins. John Talty, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You live in Alabama, and I don't know to what extent you have longtime roots to Alabama and longtime devotion to Alabama and its football program. But obviously you know thoroughly Nick Saban and have written about him extensively. Talk about this particular book and the way in which you were looking at Nick Saban, in a sense, in a different way or in a different context than you did in your previous book.
Yeah, I think for this one, it was much more about where Nick Saban was in this moment of time versus, you know, my first book was more about the totality of his career and life, and was really written in a way of trying to take, you know, business and life principles out of what's made him so successful. And so having, you know, covered him for a long time and written a book about him where I felt like I really understood who this guy was and really got under, you know, underneath the hood, for me, this was such a fascinating time for Nick Saban where, you know, he has all these threats kind of coming at him where it's, you've got these rival programs that are rising up, Georgia and Kirby Smart being chief among them. You've got all these new things he's having to try to deal with, whether that's, you know, paying players, the transfer portal, which is allowing guys to come and go essentially as they please. And, you know, it's this kind of, we refer to him as like the old king of the sport, but this guy who's, you know, in his early 70s and trying to find a way to, you know, can he rally one more run to win a national championship? And so, you know, when we started this process, you know, I didn't know Nick Saban was going to retire at the end of our journey with him. It ended up, I think, leading us to a really interesting narrative place. But, you know, it was more of just, I knew that there wasn't going to be that much more time with him, and I wanted to see someone who has, you know, dominated the sport for so long. What is that, you know, that time period like for them toward the end where it's getting harder for them to win, and there's more and more challenges that they have to overcome?
Your book actually begins with Nick Saban kind of sort of exploding, not that he was shouting or screaming, but at a public event, he really vented some of his increasing frustration, as well as his ardent belief that some of his Alabama's rivals were engaging in absolutely despicable behavior as far as he was concerned. And he was saying something out loud that apparently would not typically be said out loud. I thought it was a really interesting choice and a good choice for your book to begin with this moment in Nick Saban's career. Tell us more about this moment and why you think it was a great way to enter this story.
Well, I think it was such a flashpoint, and I think, you know, we've come a long way since then, where I think it's much more widely accepted, you know, here in 2024 that, you know, players are getting paid. But in that moment when Nick Saban said, you know, as some people would put it, the quiet part out loud, that, you know, Texas A&M had bought every member of their class. I mean, this was a shot across the bow. Certainly that's how Jimbo Fisher, the Texas A&M head coach, took it. And this is something that you didn't say out loud. It's something that, you know, for many, many years, there's been money being exchanged, you know, underneath the table. There are what we call $100 handshakes that have been happening, especially here in the South where I live. You know, this is kind of part of the culture, but it was never talked about. It was always done in the shadows. It was not meant to, you know, ever really come to light because it was technically against the rules. And so that's always been that culture of, you know, we don't talk about that. And so for a rival head coach to, you know, levy those accusations, and not just any head coach, but the greatest college football coach of all time, to say that about his one-time protege, I think to me really spoke to where we are, and certainly where we were in that moment of college football. And it actually was the reason why I wanted to do this book. And the reason why is because it just set off such alarms in my head that, you know, where you had two guys who know each other well, that worked together at LSU in the early 2000s, they won a national championship together. And for Nick Saban to do what he did, and then for Jimbo Fisher to respond the next day with a, you know, hastily called press conference in which he called Nick Saban a narcissist. He suggested he should have been slapped more as a child. He essentially said people think that they're God and I know how they really act. I mean, it was just wild stuff. And I thought to myself, what could possibly be happening within college football for these two guys to want to do this? And that was really the kind of the impetus to want to go down this journey. And, you know, from there, we start there, and then we end with, again, Nick Saban out of the game. It just felt like it was a good way to kind of bring this book to life.
A number of coaches are looked at, but, of course, another really, really big name is that of Jim Harbaugh, for some years the coach at Michigan, and, of course, an NFL veteran. I'm old enough to remember Jim Harbaugh, number four, with the Chicago Bears. And of course, one does not even have to follow college football all that closely to have some awareness of his checkered career, not so much in terms of on-field success, but off-the-field difficulties and controversy. Does the story of Jim Harbaugh resonate in a different way in terms of the story of chaos in college football?
It's a different level of chaos, really, and I think Jim Harbaugh, I think, is illustrative in a few ways. And I think one of them, which is, you know, a theme throughout our book, is the role of the NCAA. And I think you can look at it in a couple different lenses. Part of it that, you know, we write about kind of how we got to this moment within college sports. And it's, you know, a lot of it is the NCAA's refusal, you know, to want to evolve and want to, you know, set up a system maybe that could have allowed players to get paid in a way that was more regulated and had more rules and all those different things. The other part of it that we write about, and there's a whole chapter dedicated to the NCAA's enforcement team, but just how challenging it is, you know, for the NCAA to try to, you know, combat what they believe to be rules violations. And just there's all these different things that people can do to prevent them from being able to do it, including the fact that the NCAA doesn't have subpoena power. And Jim Harbaugh kind of became the ultimate kind of, you know, heel to the NCAA, or the ultimate, you know, target for them, where they felt like not only was he violating the rules, but also that he was, you know, kind of blatantly doing so and had no remorse about it and, you know, refused to admit his wrongdoing. And I think that set on this, you know, what we've detailed in the book, this years-long battle, even before we get to all the sign-stealing stuff, which popped up over the course of our reporting, but this, you know, this idea of him famously eating a cheeseburger with a recruit when he was technically not allowed to, and him denying it, and it taking a receipt of him being there for him to admit it, and there's just kind of this whole back and forth, and I think it kind of shows in some ways, you know, what's happening within the system of college sports.
We're speaking with John Talty, co-author of the new book, The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. It's so interesting as we delve into this story. It's not really clear who are the villains. It sort of feels like there's villains on every side, or if not villains, at least people and entities and organizations that are operating in, let's say, less than pristine fashion. And as you kind of emerged from this close examination, do you feel like you have a better idea of where the most serious wrongdoing or poor judgment has been committed in all of this?
It's a murky world. I don't think it's black or white. I think that there's a lot of finger pointing that does happen, and I can give you some of the common villains that come up when we talk to people. But what's funny about it is that, you know, you talk to some of these people and, you know, they're charming and they explain why they did what they did, and you think, all right, I kind of get that perspective too. But, you know, I think if we're looking at how do we get to this moment in time that we're in, I think some of the biggest factors, and again, it all comes back to money really, but, you know, the influence of the television industry has had a massive impact throughout college sports. It's been the primary driver of all the conference realignment that we've seen. So schools like USC and UCLA and Oregon and Washington, the fact that they're in the Big Ten now instead of the Pac-12, that's because of TV money and the TV networks wanting those properties in one conference instead of the other. So that's kind of, I think, where we start. I think part of it is the college presidents at these different universities who are in many ways overmatched and unable maybe to see the long-term ramifications of the decisions that they're making. You know, a lot of them do not have sports backgrounds, and they are just not as educated maybe as they need to be. You know, they've got a million different issues that they're dealing with on their college campuses, and sports is just one part of it, but, you know, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and so some of these decisions that they're making are going to impact their school maybe for 100 years. And I'll go back to the realignment stuff. You know, you have some of these new presidents at schools like Oregon that are making a decision to leave a conference like Pac-12, an iconic 100-plus-year conference that had, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Jackie Robinson and Missy Franklin and all these incredible athletes over the years. It's gone. And because of the decisions that college presidents made to take television money somewhere else. And then finally, one of the people that I think is interesting that maybe doesn't get talked about enough, but I look to the sports agents, particularly Jimmy Sexton, who have done a tremendous job at their job. They've done a tremendous job of, you know, really jacking up the coaching salaries for their clients because of the TV money. But I think what that did is it created a world in which the money got so big and the gulf between coach and unpaid player became so untenable to, I think, the public tenor. It forced us into this world where there's no real rules and guidelines yet because they didn't build a system to adequately pay players. You know, I think we think that's coming down the line, but, you know, it's one thing when Nick Saban was making $1.2 million at LSU in 2000. It's a lot of money, but okay, that's, you know, we get it. First making, you know, nearly $12 million at the end of his time at Alabama, I think people thought, wait a second, this guy should not be making $12 million a year and the players get nothing. And I think that played a huge role in ultimately, you know, allowing guys to start getting paid, which I think is a good thing, but it kind of forced it along maybe quicker than the system was able to account for it because of the decisions the NCAA made.
Absolutely. I want to ask you real quick about something that has figured so prominently in all of this, and and we probably have people listening to this interview that are not really close observers of the game who might not understand this whole notion of NIL, name, image, and likeness, and the way in which that can be used as a recruitment inducement. Just briefly explain how that works in all of that and the complication it has turned out to be.
Yeah, so it's kind of like what the ideal was and what it ended up being. And so the ideal was, you know, we can go back in time to some of these prominent players that people might be aware of, you know, let's say a Tim Tebow or Johnny Manziel. Well, when those guys played football, they weren't able to capitalize on their name, image, and likeness. So they couldn't sell anything. They couldn't sell jerseys of themselves. The school could, and they could make money off of it, but the players couldn't. They couldn't sign autographs for payment. In fact, Johnny Manziel and other players got in trouble for doing that. So the way it was meant to be was that when you had a prominent player who, or any player really, who had marketing value or people wanted to pay to put them in a commercial or pay them to tweet something for them or pay them to sign autographs, this was the avenue to do so. Well, what ended up happening was that it became really not about the player's actual name, image, and likeness value, and it became purely pay for play. So guys who are now making upwards of seven figures a year to play football, that is solely based on what that school's collective and boosters believe to be their value on the field and not what their marketing value is. So it got skewed pretty quickly. You know, some of us, I think, maybe who are a little more cynical or skeptical, probably expected it and did expect it. I think a lot of the people within the sport did not think that it would get kind of skewed as quickly as it did, but it completely changed the game. And we went from, all right, you know, maybe you're a Texas fan, your local car dealership pays, you know, $5,000 to an offensive lineman to promote their new, you know, Dodge Caravan, to, hey, we're going to pay this kid $2 million a year because he's a really good quarterback and we want him to play, and we're not going to actually make him do any marketing stuff. That's kind of how fast it happened. And it's led to the world we're in now, where there's just a NIL money arms race, where the schools that have the richest boosters can get the best players, and the ones who don't can't. And it's led to a lot of frustration because there's no enforcement of those rules, and the intention of behind it, which was good, has been, you know, completely upended.
Last quick question. At one point in your book, you talk about how this term of student athlete was coined in part on purpose to be a bit vague and subject to interpretation in a couple of different ways. What does that term student athlete even mean in 2024?
To me, when we write about it, I like to instead do athlete-student because that's where the priority is, and that's where the money has been put into to emphasize. Now, that's not to knock any of these kids and what they do. And, you know, I think quite a few of them, especially in all of the non-revenue sports, so everything that's not, you know, football and basketball, it is a lot about, you know, being a student first and an athlete second. But, you know, it was, we in some ways think of it almost as the original lie. And it was a way for the then NCAA president to try to preserve amateurism and try to preserve this idea that, you know, players should not be paid because they're students. They're, you know, that's different. They're different than NFL players. They're different than NBA players. And that's lasted for a really long time. It's been a successful argument for the NCAA for a really long time. But I think that the public fervor around that has changed. I think quite a few more people believe now that they should be paid, that we're seeing the hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue that's being generated, and that they do deserve a cut of that. We know that that's coming down the line with revenue sharing and a salary cap and all those different kinds of things that are much closer to the professional models that we're used to. But yeah, I think, you know, it's, when it comes to football players and basketball players, the amount of hours they have to put into their sport, the amount of travel they have to do for their sport, the amount of money that sport is generating for their university, like, they are essentially professional athletes. And they have to do all the student stuff on top. And I don't envy them at times for having to deal with all of that. But they're much closer to professional athletes at this point than student athletes. That's the world we live in right now.
And that world is illuminated very well in your new book, The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos, published by HarperCollins, and one of the authors, John Talty. John Talty, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your very interesting book.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is also something interesting for football fans, and this interview from the Morning Show archives was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2018. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about one of the biggest names in NFL history, quarterback Tom Brady. Loved by many, hated by many, and certainly a compelling figure in so many different ways. And of course, many people, even if you're not a Patriots fan, even if you're not a football fan, surely know the story of what has sometimes been called Deflategate, a controversy that surrounded quarterback Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. And it wasn't the first time that the organization itself was caught up in controversy, but this was one of the first instances in which Tom Brady was very specifically targeted and ultimately suspended for four games the following season. The story of how he came back from that public embarrassment to enjoy one of the greatest seasons of his career is told in a really riveting story and book called 12, the inside story of Tom Brady's fight for redemption. It's co-authored by Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman. And Casey Sherman is a very, very talented journalist and author with a number of books to his credit, including the absolutely marvelous books Boston Strong, The Finest Hour, Rose for Mary, and The Ice Bucket Challenge. I read Boston Strong, loved every page, and I have very much enjoyed reading 12. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Casey Sherman for the next few minutes about his new book, published by Little Brown and Company and just out. Casey Sherman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Greg.
You certainly have a great track record, and now this marvelous book. Tell us, first of all, the kind of cooperation that you were able to have with some of the key figures involved in this, including quarterback Tom Brady himself.
Yeah, we got unprecedented access into the Patriot organization, including Brady himself. Brady's never cooperated for a book before that he didn't author himself. He came out with a self-help book a year ago, but didn't really touch on any of the drama that we explore in the pages of 12. This is the biggest sports scandal in American history since the Black Sox scandal of 1919, where you had Chicago White Sox players literally throwing the World Series. And, fast forward to this day and age where you've got an equipment violation that is treated the same way, almost like a capital murder offense. So obviously the folks inside the organization wanted to tell their story. And it's really interesting, all the drama and the challenges that a guy like Tom Brady, you're looking at two of the greatest quarterbacks in the league, Brady and Aaron Rodgers, and Brady getting all of these challenges and these obstacles and overcoming it in a way that will go down in history.
One of the things that surprised me most in your really interesting book, which we should also hasten to add is not a full-blown biography, but you certainly lay out some rich context for where Tom Brady comes from, and in particular kind of the span of his whole career, even ahead of the Patriots. I think for a lot of people who have followed him and what he's done with the Patriots, it's kind of amazing to see that he was not necessarily college football's golden boy with this aura of greatness already surrounding him. At least most people who looked at Tom Brady would never have had a sense that a spectacular career in the NFL was going to follow. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what I'm talking about here.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Greg. Everybody now looks at Tom Brady as the superstar married to a supermodel, but he's always struggled to get recognition, to get his fair chance to compete on the football field, all the way going back to high school. And obviously the University of Michigan, which we write about extensively in the book, that he was never given, you know, the full confidence of any of his coaches, regardless of how well he performed on the field. That's why he was only a sixth-round draft pick in the 2000 draft. He wasn't a number one like somebody like Aaron Rodgers. This guy was an afterthought, and that fueled him because he thought he was, you know, every bit as good as your Aaron Rodgers, if not better. So that you know, self-doubt or in terms of how others perceive him really gave him the fuel that he needed to gain that massive competitive edge that I think you're seeing now.
Right. I mean, I still remember, I think it's a chapter called The Underdog, where in describing Tom Brady at a point in time when he was engaged in kind of a rivalry with another quarterback with more spectacular physical gifts, you described Tom Brady as a slow, skinny, fourth-year junior with average arm strength and the speed of a tortoise.
Well, we described him that way, but actually the NFL scouts described him that way. That was written down during the NFL Combine when they were scouting Brady, and they see this guy that, you know, on paper certainly wasn't overwhelming. In fact, he was very underwhelming. But every time he got on the football field, he, you know, pretty much led his team to victory. So there was something there that the Patriots obviously recognized. Now, they didn't recognize it well enough to draft him higher than the sixth round. The fact that he was still on the board in the sixth round is quite startling to anybody. So it was really luck of the draw for the Patriots to get this guy that would change the history of the franchise.
Right. And as one of his teammates said it so very well in their amazing Orange Bowl victory over Alabama, David Terrell said, "Brady won this game. Tom Brady showed poise. He showed the heart of a leader, the heart of a lion." And, of course, it's fair to say that by the time he does get to the NFL and ultimately to the Patriots, he's no longer skinny, and he probably no longer has average arm strength or the speed of a tortoise. But, I mean, is his greatness because, at least in part, he has elevated himself in a sense physically, or is his greatness still rooted in what he does mentally on the field?
Well, I think his physical condition now matches his mental preparedness. I think his body has finally caught up to his brain, and we're seeing a guy that has had unprecedented success over a span of 18 years in any professional sport. I mean, he's a transcendent athlete, much like Michael Jordan was, much like Muhammad Ali was. You know, what he's doing now, he's entering his training camp this year at 41 years old. Now think about that. That's insane to really grasp. I don't know if I could get out of bed without aches and pains at 41, and I don't play football every day. So imagine what he's doing at the very highest level of competition.
Absolutely amazing. Also, in terms of context, I want you to say a word about when Bill Belichick returns to New England, takes over the Patriots in February of 2000, you tell us that he realized that he had inherited a weak and dysfunctional team, one that was a far cry from the squad that played in the 1996 Super Bowl. Just how bad were the Patriots at this point in time? I think it's important to remember that because it helps us appreciate all the more what has been accomplished by the Patriots and Bill Belichick since then.
Yeah, they were it was a Pete Carroll coach team that Bill Belichick took over, and they were weak-minded. They were completely out of shape. And Bill Belichick's first, rule was to, you know, we may not have the most wins of any team in our division, but we're going to be in the best shape of any team that we face. So he really put all of his players, the ones that could stay on the roster, through an incredible endurance test in training camp. And the players that actually got to hang around and enjoy the success, they understood right away this isn't, you know, your father's Patriots team. The Patriots were always a laughing stock in the NFL. And now there was an opportunity to really achieve greatness and retain that greatness over an extraordinary period of time.
Mm. You also tell us that when Tom Brady arrives on the scene, it is without much at all in the way of fanfare and without particularly high expectations, at least generally speaking, and certainly as far as the public was concerned, it's kind of a matter of Tom who. Just say a word about how quickly Tom Brady and the Patriots were able to achieve amazing success.
Well, the only recognition he got when he joined the team, you had writers that had no idea who he was, but they were concerned that, you know, asking why would the Patriots waste a draft pick on another quarterback? They already had a franchise quarterback in Drew Bledsoe. They had a pretty, solid veteran backup quarterback as well. So to take Brady with a draft pick, they thought was a wasted pick. But the first day of training camp, Tom Brady walks up to owner Robert Kraft, and Kraft doesn't know who the heck he is. He thinks he's a pizza boy. And he looks Brady in the eye, or Brady looks him in the eye and says, I'm the best decision you ever made.
And, of course, that fairly quickly becomes very, very evident.
Yeah, we talk about, obviously, the hit heard around the world, at least in New England, when Drew Bledsoe suffered a massive hit from a New York Jets linebacker early in the 2000 season that put him out for several weeks. He almost died. We talk about, you know, the severity of the injury to Bledsoe, and that hoisted Brady into the starting lineup. He began to win, and he got that position. He would tell his friends, his boyhood friends in California or his buddies at the University of Michigan, he says, you know, I'm better than Drew Bledsoe. If I get into the lineup, I'm never going to lose this job. Mm-hmm. And he meant it, and it turned out to be very accurate.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Casey Sherman, who is the co-author of a book just published and right now one of the most discussed books in America, called 12. The inside story of Tom Brady's fight for redemption. So, it's actually the third section of the book in which you finally take on this controversy that engulfs the New England Patriots and very specifically Tom Brady. And, of course, this is a controversy that comes after at least one other very serious controversy that surrounds the Patriots. But this one very much takes aim at Tom Brady himself, a controversy that's come now to be known as Deflategate. And I think a lot of our listeners probably know at least the rough parameters of what caused this controversy in the first place. I want you to say a word about how you and your co-author have tried to approach kind of the central matter of what happened and who was guilty of what. It seems to me that you have proceeded really carefully and have tried to be fair and even-handed to all parties concerned. Say a word about what you and co-author Dave Wedge thought about in terms of handling this central aspect of the Tom Brady story.
Well, myself and my co-author were, you know, veteran investigative journalists. I've written about terrorism. I've written about organized crime. I've written about the CIA. And, you know, there are certainly elements that I've covered in my past that came to bear with this story as well, which is really what made me interested in writing this story. It really unfolds much more so like a legal thriller than it does your typical sports story. We found out that the NFL, I should say, really targeted Brady from the get-go before even investigating any of the allegations about deflated balls. They had already written their conclusion about how they wanted to tear this guy down, and that's what they did. Now, the other central character of the book is Roger Goodell, and we find him to be a fascinating character because he's very Nixonian in many ways. And, you know, we write a lot about his background, and the Nixon caricature is a bit of an irony given the fact that it was Richard Nixon that basically derailed Roger Goodell's father's political career in the early 1970s. And here you have an NFL commissioner who will do anything he can to attain power and then do anything he can to retain power. Now, you mentioned, Greg, the Spygate scandal in 2007, which was a legitimate controversy. The New England Patriots were guilty of videotaping signals from opposing teams and coaches. Now, Roger Goodell at the time, he was so close to the ownership of the New England Patriots, including Robert Kraft, that he swept that scandal and that controversy under the rug, going so far as to destroying evidence that implicated the Patriots even further. That was a Bill Belichick-fueled scandal. Brady had nothing to do with it. But the other 31 owners saw this collusion, and I use that word because we hear it so often now, between Goodell and Kraft, and they said, okay, if there's anything untoward about the Patriots moving ahead, you have to go after them with both fists. Now, there's a very Shakespearean theme to the story as well, because Robert Kraft really groomed and mentored Goodell and really put him into his position as commissioner of the NFL. And here is Roger Goodell. He has got to weigh this decision to go after his friend, to go after his father figure. You know, Kraft really mentored him, and I think Goodell looked at him as a father figure. And but in order to keep his power, he had to metaphorically slay his father, and that's what he did. He was willing to do that to keep his job.
So I was about to ask you, what possible motivation could there be for Mr. Goodell to go after Tom Brady in this way? I mean, there are plenty of NFL fans who hate the Patriots and who would love nothing more than to see something like this occur. But somebody like Roger Goodell, of course, is not going to take action because of that kind of personal animosity. So in your mind, this was all about him keeping his job and salvaging good relations with all of the other owners of the NFL.
Oh, that's right. I mean, that's where his motivation, you know, began. And it was interesting. We write, as you've read, Greg, how the NFL investigators put their chess pieces in play well before the actual football game where the Patriots were accused of deflating footballs. It was really a sting operation from beginning to end. Normally, if a team is accused of any equipment violation, they are going to get a fair warning from the league in the days leading up to the game to say, hey, we're watching for this. Make sure it doesn't happen. The Patriots weren't given any indication that this was even a possibility, and all of the lead investigators of the entire league were at Foxborough Stadium, Gillette Stadium, the night in question to allegedly catch the Patriots in the act. It's also interesting to know that there has been, in the history of the NFL, never a time that footballs had been measured during the game. It was such a minor rule in the rule books that nobody had even thought about it. Your fans obviously understand, you know, the greatness of Aaron Rodgers. Aaron came out very publicly defending Brady initially, saying, I like my footballs, you know, inflated even beyond the PSI limit because that's how I like to throw them. Now, the league was always notorious for either over-inflating or deflating footballs, and Brady was really frustrated by it because they would always overinflate his balls. So I think his equipment guys understood this. Brady said, I like my balls a certain way. Wasn't really colluding with his equipment managers. They did what they did, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, one of the biggest scandals in American history.
You tell us that there was all kinds of evidence that was cited about this, including lots of exchanges between various figures on the Patriots staff and so on. And it's an interesting sort of paper trail, mostly an electronic paper trail, but obviously we're talking very much about circumstantial evidence. And then, of course, a 243-page report comes out in which somebody is takes aim at the NFL's case and tries to kind of sort out if there's anything here. Was there anything there at all? I mean, was there reason to have these suspicions, or was this all completely a construction or fabrication?
Well, it was a fabrication or an over-amplification amplification of an equipment violation. You know, were the equipment managers of the New England Patriots complicit in deflating balls? I think so. I think the text and trail certainly leads to that assumption, at least from a journalist like me. I think Brady was an unwitting accomplice to it all. And quite frankly, you know, Brady bears responsibility for this as well this way. He could have gotten up in front of the media right away and deflated the situation himself by saying, I like my footballs, you know, a certain way. I didn't know it was an equipment violation. You know, what fine do I have to pay? Normally, a violation like that would only elicit a $10,000 fine to somebody's charity. Instead, he dug his heels in, and it's always the cover-up that's bigger than the crime. And I think that's really what fueled this. I think the NFL was all, you know, was going to target Brady regardless, but it certainly, gave them, momentum and venom to go after him with everything that they have unjustly, in my opinion.
It was interesting. I thought that one of the most intriguing matters of texts involving some of these equipment managers is when they're talking about the free stuff they want to get. And at one point, one of them uses the nickname Deflator, come help the deflator, referring to himself, actually. And this is a term that sort of leaps out at us and makes us kind of wonder just exactly what was going on and why it was going on.
Well, it leapt out at us, too. And, the Patriots tried to spin that story by saying that that equipment manager was engaged in a weight loss program, and that was his nickname. He was deflating via his weight loss, which to us is pretty ridiculous. You know, there is deceit on both sides, small, white lies or big, blown out, lies and betrayal. And that certainly is one of those things that, these guys clearly knew what they were doing. The equipment guys, to me, are comic relief in the book because they are so pathetic, in my opinion. But again, it does. I don't want that to overshadow the bigger story, which is, the NFL, the means that it will use and the lengths that it will go to control any player in the NFL. Tom Brady is the face of the entire league, and if you can bring Tom Brady under your thumb, what's that say for the seventh round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers trying to hold on to a roster spot? It shows that they are ultimately powerless against the shield of the NFL.
Say a word about the way in which the Patriots fought this, tried to fight back. I mean, you termed the story in some respects a legal thriller as much as anything else. Just how tough were the Patriots in trying to fight this? I mean, obviously, ultimately unsuccessful in those attempts, but how vociferous were those attempts to bat this away?
Initially, the owner, Robert Kraft, really came to Tom Brady's defense. He had created his own website, the Wells Report in context, basically, picking apart the league's investigation of Tom Brady. And that went on for several weeks and months, and there were threats being made that the Patriots or Robert Kraft would sue the NFL. That's certainly what fans in New England thought was going to happen, but Robert Kraft eventually said and decided to give up that fight. And, we open our book with Tom Brady learning that his owner has kind of not betrayed him, but certainly, not given him the support he needed. Tom Brady didn't know that Kraft was going to give up this fight, so Tom Brady, you can imagine, was very irritated and outraged by it. I think Tom Brady's coach, Bill Belichick, also threw him under the bus as well by, denouncing any idea about footballs and how the inflation rates are going. He just said, look at, the quarterback has to answer all those questions. Now, Belichick had never done that in his career. He always deflected the attention from his players, but Belichick was willing to put Brady on the spotlight. I think that's why we're seeing this fractured relationship here in New England right now between Belichick and Brady. There's no love lost there. I think Brady does not like his coach. He'll play under him because he has to, but I think that those two have a business relationship, and that's it.
In the chapter called Isolation, you explain what really happened for those four games in the fall of 2016 when quarterback Tom Brady was serving this four-game suspension. It's very, very intriguing, and I've never seen this matter written about with this kind of thoroughness at all. Describe to our listeners just what this suspension meant and how Tom Brady handled it.
Well, you know, the suspension meant that Brady could not have any contact with any player or member of the Patriots personnel for the first four games of the 2016 season. He could not. He was basically locked out of the stadium that, you know, he built, you know, with his own throwing arm. So here he is, you know, looking for fields to play on. He had his trainer, a very controversial trainer, Alex Guerrero, that has certainly been written about over the past, you know, 12 months. Brady looked for a receiver that could emulate some of the plays that Brady knew he would be using when he got back into the game, and he began to practice on these fields. And it was, you know, the meticulousness of the way that he went about his training method was really astonishing. And the you know, we interviewed the player that he was training with at the time, who just said, you really understand why he is the best in the business, because there's not a detail that he is not fully aware of and looking to improve upon every single time he steps back and throws a pass.
Mm. Well, the balance of your book is about Tom Brady's astonishing performance for the remainder of that 2016 season, which you term his season of redemption. And we'll kind of leave it to our listeners to explore that in all of the rich detail which you offer up. But it's safe to say that it is among the most astonishing performances by any NFL player ever.
I would say by any athlete ever as well, Greg. You'd have to go back to the fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in 1974 to really, you know, find that comparison of an older athlete against a younger, stronger, faster opponent who seemingly is losing every round and suddenly summons up the will, the strength, and the determination to throw that knockout punch. Ali did it in Africa, and Tom Brady did it in the Super Bowl against the Falcons.
Incredible. Briefly, a couple of days ago, Tom Brady was back in the news again for an unhappy reason. He was giving a press briefing to reporters. It was all very cordial until a reporter asked about receiver Julian Edelman's suspension for performance-enhancing drugs. And Julian Edelman works with Alex Guerrero, who is one of the most important trainers of Tom Brady. And quarterback Tom Brady, when this question comes up, and it was actually a relatively benign question, but it apparently made him very angry, and he cut off the conference right then and there with scarcely a comment at all. Can you just say a quick word about this, and if you suspect that there is more behind this story?
Well, I mean, there's certainly more behind the story. You know, Brady should have answered that question, because Alex Guerrero just isn't Brady's trainer. He's his business partner. The whole TV12 method is something that was developed by Brady and Alex Guerrero. And obviously, Julian Edelman has been part of the program, but he also has been, you know, lifting weights, which he, I guess, is adverse to the program itself. So there's a reason that, you know, some people could tie Edelman to the TB12 method in the PED suspension, but Brady didn't want to hear it. He should have answered that question, but he didn't. And you're seeing a guy that in the twilight of his career isn't going to be that corporate guy anymore. He's showing his personal side, his anger, and his competitive spirit more so off the field now than he ever has before.
Mm. Interesting. Just makes the story of Tom Brady all the more compelling, love him or hate him. And the book we're talking about again today, 12, The Inside Story of Tom Brady's Fight for Redemption, published by Little Brown and Company, co-authored by Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman. Casey Sherman, you've done it again, yet another fantastic book. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me.
This interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2018. And, of course, not too long after this, Tom Brady ended up spending the three final seasons of his career as a quarterback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for sunny and relatively warm temperatures. Today's high 83 degrees, overnight low of 63 degrees. And then essentially an identical forecast now through next Thursday. The only chance of rain, a slight chance of rain on Sunday. Otherwise, mostly sunny skies and temperatures in the low 80s for a high. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.